The topic of today's short talk is the science of alchemy. What is the etymology of the word alchemy, firstly? The origin of the word. It comes from combination of two words, al and chemi. Interestingly, the word chemi means fire. Also, chem was the name of ancient Egypt, chem. So this science of alchemy had one great purpose, aim, and that was to transmute base metals into gold. For example, conversion of lead into gold. That is what the moderns understand of what alchemy is. It is said that these alchemists sought for the hidden spirit in every inorganic matter. Inorganic matter, we can say in double quotes, because there is nothing in the whole of the cosmos that is inorganic or dead. This is the first thing that we have to understand. This is very well illustrated by a poem which I will read of a Sufi poet, Sadhuddin Muhammad Shabistari, in his book The Secret Rose Garden. He very graphically, very poetically describes how the whole cosmos is alive, filled with life, and filled with the potentiality. All beings are filled with the potentiality of the highest possible perfection. So he says, I quote, "Your eye has not strength enough to gaze at the burning sun, but you can see its brilliant light by watching its reflection mirrored in the water. So the reflection of absolute being can be viewed in this mirror of not being. For non-existence, being opposite of reality, instantly catches its reflection. Know the world from end to end is a mirror. In each atom, 100 suns are concealed. If you pierce the heart of a single drop of water, from it will flow 100 clear oceans. If you look intently at each speck of dust, in it you will see 1,000 beings. A gnat in its limbs is like an elephant. In name, a drop of water resembles the Nile. In the heart of a barley corn is stored 100 harvests. Within a millet seed, a world exists. In an insect's wing is an ocean of life. A heaven is concealed in the pupil of an eye. The core in the center of the heart is small, yet the Lord of both worlds will enter there." Unquote. So this very beautiful, graphical, poetical, and equally philosophical way of expressing that there is a hidden spirit or life in what we call as inorganic or dead matter. So, it is said that alchemists sought this hidden spirit in inorganic matter. It was also said that alchemists, or rather the science of alchemy, deals with the finer forces of nature and the various conditions in which they are found to operate. So the modern science deals with physical, chemical, mechanical laws and forces, but alchemists try to probe into the finer forces of nature. And if you look at the contribution which alchemists have made, historically we find that chemistry has derived most of its techniques and principles from alchemists and their works. So alchemy has played a very important role even though modern science does not completely understand alchemy and thinks it to be an improbable science, an occult science which is discounted, still we find that alchemists had a great contribution in the history of origin of chemistry itself. For example, we find this. See, they were the ones who extracted metals from ores. They produced a number of inorganic acids and bases that later became commercially important. They were the ones who developed the techniques of fusion, calcination, solution, filtration, crystallization, sublimation, and most importantly, distillation. All these are used in chemistry today. All these techniques are used in chemistry. And they were the ones who systematically recorded the results of their experiments with elements and metals. And they were the ones who predicted the chemical reaction between various chemical components. And this arrangement, systematical study, recording and arrangement of the results of their experiments is what finally led to the periodic table, which we so extensively use in chemistry today. So this being said, alchemy is generally misunderstood. If you read about alchemy in the books of science, modern science, not much is understood by modern science as to what alchemy is, the inner essence of alchemy, we should say. The reason is most of the alchemical works were written in symbolical, cryptic and veiled language, and there is a very profound reason for such for this, very great reason for this. If you take an alchemical book and try reading it, it doesn't make head or tail. We cannot make any sense of it unless we have the key to decode the meaning, the hidden meaning which those words and those terminologies and the various metaphors that are used represent. Artifius, it seems, was a great hermetic philosopher, and he wrote his work called as the Secret Book in 12th century, and the legend says when he wrote this, his age was already 1000 years. That's what the legend says. And if this book is available, and if you take this book and read the very first paragraph of it, it reads like this. So let me read this interesting paragraph and then take our discussion forward. First paragraph says, I quote, antimony is a mineral participating of saturnine parts and has in all respects the nature thereof. This saturnine antimony agrees with sol and contains in itself argent vial, in which no metal is swallowed up except gold, and gold is truly swallowed up by an antimonial argent vial. Without this argent vial, no metal whatsoever can be whitened. It whitens latent gold, reduces the perfect body into its prima materia or first matter, which is into sulfur and argent vibe of a white color and outshining a looking glass. It dissolves, I say, the perfect body, which is so in its own nature, for this water is friendly and agreeable with the metals, whitening sol, because it contains in itself white or pure argent vibe. So this is the first paragraph, and we can make no sense of it if we read this. I mean, it appears as good as Greek and Latin. This is just like looking at a complex chemical formula involving hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur, calcium, and so on and so forth, represented in a beautiful chemical formula. But unless we know what each of those symbols represent, what each of those reactions which are mentioned about that chemical reaction represent, what those numbers represent, we can make no sense of even chemical reactions. H2O, what do we make of it unless we know what H represents, what O represents, what is 2? How did the hydrogen and oxygen come together to form water? We may be using water, but if we represent it chemically and not know the hidden, not know the symbol and its meaning, it makes no sense to us. So, why did alchemists use such a veiled language? The reason is, as was already said, they dealt with finer forces of nature. And the more finer the forces of nature is, the more potent and strong and powerful it is. And they could not give the secrets of these finer forces of nature to those who are not ready. Imagine, even with mere advancement in physical technology and discovery of a portion of atomic power, what all chaos we have produced in the world. A glimpse into the finer forces of nature would be a thousandfold stronger than any of the atomic bomb, nuclear holocaust. So they who experimented in it and probed into the deeper mysteries of nature, these alchemists always used veiled language, because if these works come into the hand of the selfish world, it will be misused, abused, and causes great harm to the whole of mankind. So those only who were initiated into the mysteries of life could know the complete meaning and decode the symbols. What are the basic principles of alchemy, and how does it relate to our everyday life, is what we will see in the next few minutes. Firstly, let's consider what chemistry says. What is the world view of chemistry? Chemistry is broadly classified as organic, inorganic, and the basic world view of chemistry is, the basic perspective of chemistry is, whole of nature, world, cosmos is composed of molecules. Molecules themselves are composed of atoms. Atoms, broadly classifying, are composed of three basic components: protons, neutrons, and electrons. Of course, now they say that proton cells are not the fundamental building blocks, but there are other subatomic particles called quarks, which form photon, and so on and so forth. So one element interacts with another element through their electrons. Photons and protons and neutrons form the nucleus of the atom, and electrons is the ones which whirl around the atom. And when the electrons of two elements react, the study of this reaction is chemistry. And what is it that defines one element uniquely? What is it that makes one element differ from another element? It is the number of protons in that one atom. That is called as atomic number. Each, if there are, let's say, gold, for example, has the atomic number 79. Which means 79 protons are there. So each element has a unique atomic number, which is defined by the number of protons in that atom, and that is what uniquely identifies the atom, that element. Further, chemists also agree that this transmutation of lead into gold is possible. The great aim of alchemist, conversion of lead into gold, is possible, is agreed by modern physical science. They say, modern physicists say, and chemists say, that it cannot be possible through chemical means, but you will have to use great energy, expend great energy and do what is called as nuclear transmutation to convert lead into gold. Theoretically possible, practically also possible, but the amount of energy that is required to convert lead into gold is so much that such a venture is not profitable. That is what the modern chemists say. Now, coming to alchemists and alchemy, their basic principle is that there is something called as a universal solvent. This universal solvent, also called as the philosopher's stone, is something by which all composite bodies are resolved into the homogeneous substance from which all of them have evolved. So there is a homogeneous substance. A modification of that homogeneous substance produces many elements, and there is something called as philosopher's stone, which when it is applied to any of the element will resolve that element back to its homogeneous substance. And it is said that this solvent, the philosopher's stone, has the power of removing all seeds of disease from human body, of renewal, of renewing youth and prolonging life. When applied to human body, it has that power of removing all diseases and prolonging life, renewing youth. So this is what alchemists say. If you look at the three basic aspects in which alchemy was studied, that is very interesting. This study, alchemy, had three different aspects in it: terrestrial, human and cosmic. And look at this, they represented each of these aspects by a particular material. For example, terrestrial, when they dealt with terrestrial alchemy, they called it a terrestrial alchemy of salt. And human, they represented it by mercury, and the cosmic by sulfur. But we must remember that all these different metals that they use are very symbolical. That is primary point to be remembered. There is this French alchemist of 18th century, in his work Alchemical Catechism, he says this, that the usage of all metals is symbolical. He makes it very clear. In that particular work, a question is asked. When the philosopher, I quote, the question is, when the philosophers speak of gold and silver from which they extract their matter, are we to suppose that they refer to the vulgar gold silver? Answer is, by no means. Vulgar gold and silver are dead, while those of the philosophers are full of life. That is what the occult, alchemical catechism says. So when alchemists said that they want to convert lead into gold, they meant something entirely different than conversion of the physical metal lead into gold. This is one point. Even Heinrich Kundrath, who was an early 17th century alchemist, he made a very important point that this whole alchemical process is what occurs deep inside the alchemist's soul. The soul of the alchemist is where the alchemical processes take place, not outside in the laboratory. Outside, whatever is represented is only symbolical of that inner transmutation that happens. See, we see this in very clearly mentioned in Isis Unveiled, which we are studying Sunday mornings. See, about alchemist, HPB says this, disdaining, I quote, disdaining the rewards of petty traffic, spurning wealth, luxury, pomp and worldly power, they aspire to knowledge as the most satisfying of all acquisition. They esteemed poverty, hunger, toil and the evil report of men as none too great a price to pay for its achievement. They who might have lain on downy velvet-covered beds suffered themselves to die in hospitals and by the wayside rather than debase their souls and allow the profane cupidity of those who tempted them to triumph over their sacred vows. The lives of Paracelsus, Cornelius Agrippa and Philalethes are too well known to repeat the old sad story." Unquote. So we find that true alchemists never concerned themselves with the physical transmutation because gold was nothing for them. The most satisfying of all acquisition is true spiritual knowledge, and that is what they aspired for. And this is very clearly understandable because of the basic principle which all true philosophers emphasize on, that man is not a physical being at all. There is a spiritual aspect in man which is permanent, which is his true identity, and that is what has to be sought for, and not clinging to body and its comforts. There's a very nice verse in Viveka Chudamani where the attitude of one who aspires to Brahma Jnanam, true spiritual wisdom, and how he avoids all physical comforts and luxuries is mentioned here. He says, I quote, "He who wishes to realize the Atman through the indulgence of the body is one who wishes to cross a river on the back of a crocodile, thinking it is a log of wood." Unquote. So that is a danger that one who wishes to attain spiritual wisdom will have if he clings to body and its comforts. So how can the true alchemist be concerning himself with conversion of lead into gold to make profit out of it? Never. Further he says, I quote, "For the seeker of liberation, attachment to the body is the great debt, Mahamrityu. He alone deserves liberation who is free from this attachment." Unquote. Further, "Give up your attachment to the body, wife and sons, which is the great debt. Conquering it, the sages reach the supreme state of Brahman." And we find Lao Tse, a Chinese philosopher, while classifying what are the principles in man, he doesn't even consider the physical body as man. He calls it as cadaver, a dead body. The body is not even a part of his classification of what man is. Inner real principles in man which are more important than the physical body. And you know, one who studies the yoga aphorisms of Patanjali will find this very evidently. One of the primary principle, fundamental block on which the yoga philosophy is built is the supreme importance of soul and the relative unimportance of the physical body. This is something that we must all remember. So what is the transmutation then these alchemists sought for? It is a transmutation inside ourselves. The transmutation that happens deep inside our mind. Transmutation of our character, of our nature, such that what is lead, which is a base metal, is converted into gold, which is of noble quality. That is the transmutation that they all sought for, inside man, within man. The transmutation of the lower principles of desire and all its various ramifications and all the, you know, which proceeds from ignorance, transmutation of that nature, our mind basically, into something that is divine, that is holy. That is the transmutation that they sought, and they said that this transmutation is the purpose of life. Why are we all here in this world of existence? It is because we are going through this process of transmutation, of converting our lower material self into a better spiritual self. The animal in man has to be made human. What is human in man has to convert it into divine, and that is the purpose of life. This is what the true alchemist thought. You know, in one of the articles in the TM magazine a couple of years ago, a Sufi story of Idresh Shah, probably that's how he spelled, Idresh Shah, was mentioned. Very nice Sufi story that deals with this idea of transmutation. The Tales of the Sand is the name of that story, wherein a stream flows from the top of the mountain, crossing various obstacles, and then it reaches the desert. Many times it tries to cross the desert, but each time its water used to sink deep into the sand and it was not able to cross the desert. So what is this stream and what is this desert? The stream is that stream of consciousness, and the desert is this world of illusion. And overcoming this desert and reaching to that other part is the aim of that stream. So the stream inquires, what should I do? How should I cross? I'm stuck here. I can't go forward. I can't go back. What shall I do? So a voice replies, the voice of the wind, which says, transform yourself. Give yourself up to me. I will carry you like moisture, and then I'll drop you at the other side like rain, and then you can flow forward from there. And then the stream is worried, how will I lose my identity? Will I become something else? So the wind says, you are off. What you actually think you are is not you. You have a mistaken identity. It says something to you, you have a mistaken identity. If you stay here thinking that you will try to cross in the way that you are without transmuting yourself, then you will become a quagmire, you will become a quicksand, and you will suffer, you will die here. So give yourself up to wind so that it carries you in a different form, and then you will be, you know, dropped as raindrops, and then you can carry forward your journey. And you know, this wind, that whisper in the wind says this: you cannot in either case remain so, which means you cannot remain in this state without progressing. Your essential part is carried away and forms a stream again. You are called what you are even today because you do not know which part of you is the essential one, unquote. Very symbolical and deeply significant, you know, words these are. So, transmutation, that's the subject. You know, in order to understand this transmutation, we must briefly mention the ancient view of man. How did the ancient alchemist saw man and nature? They said that, of course, the physical body is not man at all. Instead, there is a threefold aspect in man. The physical body is the lowest, which refers to salt again. And then there is the inner man, which refers to mercury. And then there is sulfur in him, they said, the highest. Now if you look at these three elements, it's so suggestive, you know, so symbolical. Look at this salt. Salt is something solidifying. It's a physical body, solidified. The true alchemists never concerned themselves with this salt. And then next is the inner, mercury. Mercury is the only metal which flows, right? In room temperature, it is in liquid form, and it is reflective. It reflects something. Reflective metal. It is malleable, which means it takes the form in the container in which it is placed. What does this represent? It represents our mind. In one aspect, it represents our mind, because mind has that tendency to take on the shape of the subject or object to which it is directed. Think of something bad, our mind takes on that form, you know, and then it takes on that character, that color, and absorbs it. It has that absorptive faculty. Just like you pour some amount of mercury into a square shaped box, the mercury takes the shape of squareness. If it is in a round vessel, it takes the shape of roundness. So also is mind. How you direct the mind, to that it becomes. You know, in the likeness of it, it grows. And sulfur is fire, you know, sulfur is fire. And sulfur, the very word sulfur, comes from the word to burn. It burns. So that is that deep inner spiritual self that is there. When you direct your mind to that, it burns away all ignorance. It burns away all those seeds which makes us commit sin and fault and put ourselves and others in misery. And interestingly, sulfur is bright yellow in color. Bright yellow in color. So basically what we are seeing here is that by using all these different symbols, they represented that mind of man is in the midst of two contrary forces, we may say. One is a material force attached to body and desires, the lower material self. And on the other end is the higher spiritual self, which is divine. Both are there in man. As Krishna says in the 16th chapter, the godlike quality and the demonical quality, both are present in man. As we direct our mind to either of them, in the likeness of it we grow. If today we find demonical character in men and ourselves, and demonical tendencies displayed by men at large, it is because our mind is directed along those lines through wrong ideas. So, you know, in the Manusmriti, it is very clearly mentioned that mind alone is the cause of bondage and liberation. What is it that binds you to body? It is your mind. What is it that will allow you to liberate yourself? It is your mind. Let me read this. Mana eva manushyanam karanam bandha mokshasyo bandhaya vishayasaktam muktyai nirvishyam smartham. Which means mind alone is the cause for the bondage and liberation of men. Attachment to objects of sense through the mind makes for bondage. Bandhyaya vishayasaktam. While the withdrawal from them leads to liberation. So who is it who can liberate us? Who is it who can bind us into this world of misery? Ourselves, our own mind. The way we direct our mind, that is how we are weaving our future. And elsewhere he develops on this idea very nicely. Let me mention that also. Producing attachment to objects like the body, etc., the mind binds a man with a rope as if he were an animal. Later, the same, which is the mind, creates aversion for them and liberates him from that self-same bondage. So there is this Rosicrucian treatise mentioned in the glossary, which says something like this, again cryptic, but we can gain something out of this. It says, from the first ends produced the two contraries, thence came the three principles, and from them the four elementary states. And now look at this is important. If you separate the pure from the impure, you will have the stone of the philosophers, unquote. if you separate the pure from the impure, then you will find the philosopher's stone. Now, the chemists of today thought that philosopher's stone is an object which all the alchemists are searching for and which can never be found. So the answer is here. You separate the pure from the impure, then you will find the stone of the philosophers. What is the separation of pure from impure? Separation of your mind, which is steeped in impurity and material concerns and selfishness, and transforming into the pure, and there we find the philosopher's stone, which will transmute everything into pure gold, which will transmute our nature, which is lead in character, into pure gold. And another point is, philosopher's stone is said to have the power of removing all the seeds of disease we saw in the beginning. That is because this philosopher's stone symbolizes our divine self. This universal solvent, philosopher's stone, denotes our divine self. And it has the power of removing all the seeds of disease, is removing the disease of our mind. What is the fundamental disease of mind which gives rise to all other diseases? Fundamental disease is the disease of separation.
Avidya,
ignorance. And it is from this basic darkness in our mind that all other diseases, physical, mental, moral, arise. And philosopher's stone, which is our real divine self, is the cure for this disease, for all these diseases. In the fourth chapter, you know, we find Krishna saying that Nahi Jnanena Sadrusham Pavitram, which is, there is no purifier in this world compared to spiritual knowledge. Highest purifier, spiritual knowledge. And you know how symbolical the whole world is of the higher, you know, in a way, the higher truths are represented even in the physical activities, in the physical processes of nature. Most metaphysical truths are represented in this. One of the examples is, look at how beautifully this is represented in nature. We spoke of atomic number, right? How the atomic number defines the uniqueness of that particular element. The atomic number of lead is 82. And the atomic number of gold is 79. Which means, in order to convert lead into gold, 3 protons have to be knocked off. 3 protons have to be knocked off. In one way, we can understand that what are these 3 things to be knocked off. In the Bhagavad Gita, we get some hints. And if we study the principles of man, we get more hints. And look at this, lead is already gold. It is only because there are 3 extra protons in it that it appears as lead. If you knock off the 3 protons, then lead is already gold. Which means, potentially we are all divine. We may appear to be like normal mortals, steeped in ignorance, doing all the mistakes, creating problems for ourselves and others, injustice, desire, anger, covetousness. But potentially we are divine. Potentially we are all divine. And the 3 things to be removed, in a way we can understand, is what Krishna says in one of the chapters, that there are 3 gates of hell: desire, anger, covetousness. It is these 3 things that have to be eradicated from our nature, and then we find that we are already gold, which is divine. So nicely represented, which is why, you know, St. Paul says that this world is an enigmatic mirror of pure truth. the pure truth that man is fundamentally divine, but he appears mortal, is represented even in chemical, chemically it also it is represented. So what we'll do now is, we'll consider one story from Sufi tradition, which shows how this transmutation of which speaks about this again, this transmutation of man's character from lead into gold, and then how when this transmutation is complete, he will find that he was always gold. Lead, his appearance as lead was only temporary, and this is what we find in if we correctly study the Hindu scriptures and all other scriptures, we find this clearly mentioned. In brief, that man is spiritual, he is involved in the physical psychic and mental spheres, and due to ignorance of his true nature, he commits various mistakes, and he gets the reactions of it, consequences of it. Through that we learn and reach back to our true state. You know, this journey of the soul is mentioned in the story, which speaks about the 30 birds, and there are these 30 birds who decide that they have to go and meet the king of the bird, which is called a Simurgh in the Persian literature, and they all undertake a great journey and face many hurdles, just like the soul of each being is passing through this great journey in order to reach Simurgh, which is its real true spiritual self, and it finds various bewildering things and various obstacles and troubles, overcomes it and reaches Simurgh. What happens in the story is, these birds reach that place, that castle of Simurgh, and the poet says this: when they, that is the birds, cast furtive glances towards the Simurgh, they perceived that the Simurgh was no other than the selfsame 30 birds. So when these birds go and find Simurgh, they find that the Simurgh is themselves. In other words, he is representing that the highest God is within each one of us. It is not to be sought outside, but in your deep spiritual self is that God which you are searching for. Further, he says, in utter bewilderment, they lost their wits and wondered whether they were own selves or whether they had been transformed into the Simurgh. Then to themselves they turned their eyes, and wonder of wonders, those selfsame birds seemed to be one Simurgh. Here the poet is showing that there is only one spiritual self which is reflected in all this. There are no multiple selves. Again, further he says, again, when they gazed at both in a single glance, they were convinced that they and the Simurgh formed in reality only one being. This single being was the Simurgh, and the Simurgh was this being. That one was this, and this one was that. Look where they would, in whatever direction, it was only the Simurgh they saw. No one has heard of such a story in the world, unquote. And then in the story, this bird speaks to the 30 birds which have come to meet Simurgh, and very metaphysical discourse it gives, and the poet has concealed it in very poetic language. He says, I quote, all that you have known and seen is neither that which you have known nor that which you have seen. What you have said or heard is neither this nor that. If you have succeeded in crossing the valley of the spiritual road, if you have been able to do good deeds, you have only acted under compulsion from me, and you have thus been able to see the face of my essence and of my perfections. It is well that you have been able to do this. You 30 birds, remain bewildered, impatient and astonished. As for me, I am more than 30 birds. I am the very essence of the Simurgh. Unhighlight yourselves in me joyfully and gloriously so that you find yourselves in me." Unquote. So this is something that we can contemplate on and represents that truth which all philosophies speak of, which is that man is essentially divine. Lead contains gold in it potentially. It is only that there is accumulation of certain extra things which have to be knocked off during our journey of life, and then we find that we were always Simurgh, to use the language of the poet, or we were always gold, to use the language of the alchemist. And finally, the poet ends with this: "Thereupon the birds lost themselves forever in the Simurgh. The shade thus vanished in the sun. Neither the traveller remained, nor the guide, nor the path. Finding the Simurgh, they found themselves, and the riddle of I and thou was solved." Very philosophical. So let's end here with what in the same work the poet says, that these 30 birds crossed 7 valleys. Again, look at that number, 7. 7 valleys to reach Simurgh. And he also mentions what those 7 valleys are, which is something good to remember, because it is through this, crossing through these 7 valleys, that we transmute ourselves, convert our character, change our nature, so that we are able to reflect the perfection which is already there within us. Knock off the 3 protons, to use a chemical terminology. The 7 valleys are talab, which is yearning, ishq, love, marifat, gnosis, istighna, detachment, tawheed, unity of God, hayrat, bewilderment, and finally fana, which is complete oblivion of or destruction of self. In other words, complete destruction of the separateness of self. That idea of separateness which arises from ignorance is destroyed through marifat, gnosis, jnana. So for us, the alchemical book for transmuting ourselves is the book of ancient sages, which speak about the science of life and show us this way of transmuting ourselves into pure gold. And after the stage of fana, which is complete destruction, utter destruction of the personal self, comes the final stage, which is baka, immortality.